Let's cultivate our motivation. We're able to meet the Dharma due to the kindness of all those who have practiced before us, and specifically the kindness of all the monastics individually and the monastic community as a whole, which preserve the teachings generation after generation, century after century, from the time of the Buddha down to the present day. And so feeling that gratitude and indebtedness to their kindness for preserving the teachings, both scripture and realization, then let's make a determination to do our part to continue to preserve the Dharma for future generations. And so we'll learn about the Manas community, and we'll do it for the benefit of all beings, so that they can encounter, and we can encounter, and all of us can practice these precious teachings. Yesterday we talked about the Buddha's life, and now in talking about this, it isn't simply so that we can learn the quote-unquote facts of the Buddha's life, but more so that we can apply the lessons we can learn from the Buddha's life to our own practice, so that we can learn from the example of how the Buddha lived, because his whole life is a teaching and how to practice. Sometimes nowadays in America, people question the need for monastic life. And they seem to have forgotten that the Buddha himself was a monastic. Yeah, that seems to kind of have gone beyond them. Because if you think, if you are a fully enlightened being wanting to benefit others in the best way, what would be the lifestyle that you would lead that would benefit others most effectively? Well, the Buddha showed us that through his own life. He lived as a monastic. And so I think that's an important fact to remember, that the Buddha was telling us something through his own example of how to practice and how to live. Okay, so today we're going to talk a little bit about the monastic community as a whole, as a group. It's like we mentioned at lunch, people think about, oh, I want to get ordained, but they don't think about what do you do the day after you get ordained. For the rest of your life. So it's very helpful to think about that a little bit. There were definite stages in the development of the Sangha, and I'll just kind of outline them and then go back and talk about them in a little bit more depth. Initially, the Sangha was simply a group of wanderers, you know, people who had taken the Buddha as their teacher, the Dharma as the teaching that they followed. And they, lived out in the forest and wandered from place to place. Then, after some time, and I'll describe how this happened, they became a more settled order. And, you know, some of them began to live in one place and settle down and not wander so much. And those were mostly in the avaras and aramas that were used. Those were the residences used for the rainy seasons retreat. After that, the Sangha as a community, and this happened slowly over time, it wasn't all in the Buddha's lifetime. Slowly, then you began to have several communities, okay, that were called linas or monasteries. And so here the sanghas, you began to have several sangha communities that were living in a monastery, and they functioned as united communities. And then later on, these sangha formed into these big monastic universities, like Odandapuri and Vikramashila and Nalanda. So this kind of happened over the centuries. So you see this kind of evolution from wanderer to a settled community to actually groups of people who live together with a common purpose, you know, as a community to monastic universities. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning, at the time of the Buddha, okay? So remember, at the time of the Buddha, there were the two main kind of religious groups. There were the Brahmins, who were a caste, and they recited the Vedas and very much had this belief that if a ritual was properly done, then you receive some kind of blessing, and that was the way to happiness. And they, had the power in society. Then you had the people, the Shramanas, who kind of rejected that, and they were the groups of wanderers, and there were six other predominant groups of wanderers at the time of the Buddha, but aside from these six predominant ones, there were lots of other ones too. Because, you know, you just kind of renounced and then you wandered, and everybody had slightly different, well, or greatly different doctrines, greatly different practices. Like I was saying yesterday, some shaved their heads, some had matted hair, some were very indulgent, some were very ascetic, some, you know, spoke a lot, some kept silent. They did all sorts of very different practices. So when the Buddha, when his first disciples came, you know, those five companions that he taught the Four Noble Truths to, when they became monastics, it was just a very kind of natural thing. They were already alms people who depended on alms. They were already kind of ascetics, but not, you know. And so they simply changed, you know, their teachers to the Buddha and their teachings to the Buddha's Dharma. And that's how these groups all differentiated themselves by who their leader was and what they practiced. Okay, so they were the initial monastics, and they just continued wandering. I mean, that was the lifestyle then. They wore rags and they went into town once a day and collected alms and came and ate their meal and then meditated mostly in the afternoon. And you know, they were in jungles, they were in forests, sometimes they were in cities, you know, a whole variety of different places. But they didn't necessarily hang together always as a group or do things as a group. They were united in the sense that they had the same lifestyle, but they didn't always, you know, do everything together, and they certainly weren't an institution of any kind. And during the very beginning, there weren't there weren't the precepts, okay? Sometimes we call them vows. I think it's better to call them precepts or trainings, because we tend to think of vows, you know, I vow that, and if you break it, you go to hell. And that's not quite so much how the Buddha meant it. The Buddha, you know, when he laid down these things, established these things, they were more as guidelines. This is how you're training your mind. Okay? In other words, if we could do all these things perfectly, we wouldn't need to you know, to be ordained. So we're training our minds by training our minds in these guidelines and following these guidelines. Okay, so see them as trainings. You know, don't bring up a Catholic thing of, you know, they were vows and you're going to hell if you break them, because that's not how the Buddha set things out. But anyway, at the beginning, there weren't any precepts, there weren't any trainings. They just wandered and, you know, practiced according to the Buddha's teachings. And all the precepts evolved because certain monastics would do certain behaviors, and then somebody would go to the Buddha and say, huh, is this becoming of a monastic or not? And the Buddha would look and go, uh-uh, you know, this person kind of, they were way off track. And so then he would set up this guideline or set up this training, you know, that said, do not do X, Y, and Z. So all the trainings came about because of specific instances, okay, specific mistakes that the, you know, his disciples made. And so it was, I think it was for the first 6 years, no, it was the first 12 years, there were no precepts. And then what happened, the first one was established because one monk, it was kind of taken for granted that they were all celibate, you know, the Buddha didn't need to say anything. Well, one monk, he had been married before, and his wife, you know, his ex-wife very much wanted a child, and his parents wanted him to have a child because they wanted an heir, okay? And so they pressured him and pressured him and pressured him, and so finally he thought, okay, I'll go back, I'll have sex with my wife, she'll get pregnant, have a child, then I'm off the hook, okay? So that's what he did. And then somebody went to the Buddha and said, you know, one of your monks went and had sex with his ex-wife. Is this kosher? And the Buddha said, uh-uh, forget it. You know, that is not becoming behavior for a monastic. And so then he, you know, established that training, the celibacy training. And so, you know, there are stories behind all the different ones. And what I find interesting when you read these stories is sometimes the situation is one in which you could understand how somebody could do that, you know? Because in this case, if you think of the ancient Indian culture, where you had so much filial piety, so much feeling of indebtedness to your parents and their kindness, there was so much pressure to have a child, to have an heir, you know, and a namesake and all this. So you could almost see how this monk would do it because of the social pressure and the conditioning and the wishes of his family. Okay, so it wasn't that he just went off and had a fling. It was, you know, there was some kind of understandable purpose here. But even with that understandable purpose, the Buddha said, uh-uh, that's not correct behavior. Okay. Also, for example, the training of not to lie about our attainments, that's another one of the root precepts, is not to claim that you have realizations that you don't have. Well, the situation behind those was that there's a group of a great famine, you know, across the land. And after some months, I think it was after the rainy season, the monks came together, and most of them were very, very thin because they hadn't been able to collect much on the alms round. There was a famine. But there was a certain group that were all kind of round and chubby and well-fed. And somebody said, well, what did you do? What happened to you? You don't look like the rest of us. And they said, well, you know, there was a famine. We were starving. We were hungry. And so in order to get food, we told people that, you know, we had actualized single-pointed concentration and had developed these various jhanic states and had various realizations. And then because they had faith and respect, then they gave us food to offer. You know, they offered us food. Okay. Now, you can understand in a situation where there's famine and you're starving, you could think, oh yeah, you know, you could lie in order to get some food. Yeah, you know, you can understand that. The Buddha said, no, that's not okay. Not even in the situation where you're starving to lie about your spiritual attainments. Okay? The story about the precept of killing was the Buddha, the disciples were doing a lot of these asubha meditations, like I was talking about yesterday, meditating on the loathsomeness of the body and, you know, the ugliness of the body, and your body's made up of, you know, all these organs and blood and lymph and liver and kidneys and, you know, all this stuff, not so beautiful inside. So some of them were doing this meditation, and they meditated in a slightly incorrect way, so that at the end they just hated their body and they felt, I want to be free of my body, so I want to die. You know, I don't want to have this polluted body, so better get rid of it as soon as possible. They didn't think of nirvana as a way to get rid of their body. They thought of killing themselves as getting a way of getting rid of their body. And so some of them asked some of the other monks to kill them. Yeah, so this is assisted suicide. Yeah, this guy's meditating incorrectly. He feels, I hate my body, I want to die, please kill me. So here it is, you know, somebody's asking for your assistance in dying. So this other monk did it, yeah, and Buddha came along and said, that's not good, just if somebody asks you to kill them to assist them in suicide. Okay? So it was a situation where you could see, you know, somebody asked for it, you weren't taking a life that, you know, murdering somebody in cold blood because you were angry and they wanted to live. No, this was, you know, people who didn't want to live and they asked you. So, you know, but even in that situation, it wasn't okay to kill. Okay, so you know, there were all these different situations that came up. And, you know, then somebody would say something to the Buddha, and then the Buddha would form a precept. Okay? Later on, as different events happen, sometimes the details of a precept would be slightly changed a little bit or added on to, you know, like there was one about you're not supposed to, what was it, stuff your cushions with wool, you know, because in most places wool was very expensive and it was a luxury. But then later on, you know, some monks in a place where there was lots of wool, they still couldn't use it, so then they had flat cushions and something happened. So the Buddha heard about it and said, well, in that situation it's okay, because it's not a luxury item, there's a lot of it around. Okay, so the Buddha always was very practical and in different situations made for, certain... The precept would be a certain way, then there were certain exceptions, you know, according to the situation. And so, you know, these things would happen, they would be run by the Buddha, he would, you know, make a refinement of one of the precepts. Okay, so the Tibetans say that all of the monks' precepts, I think there were, what was it, six naughty monks, and all of the mistakes were made by these six, and the same with the nuns. I think there were six, or maybe the Tibetans said there were 12, I can't remember. You know, there were naughty ones, and so they, because of them we have all the trainings. But then they say, we actually have to say thank you very much, because without them we wouldn't have these trainings to follow, and the trainings help our mind. Now, whether it was really due to just a small group, you know, it's up to you to decide that, you know. Because some of them, you can't imagine how they would just continue to stay monastics if they kept on misbehaving like this. But anyway, that's how the story goes. So, in the morning, they would live sometimes close to each other, sometimes, you know, in different places, and wake up in the morning, do a little bit of meditation, then they would go into town for their alms and collect alms. And it's not begging. They weren't beggars. They weren't allowed to ask for food. Okay, it's very strong. You're not allowed to ask. But rather they would have their alms bowl and walk through the villages or towns, and people who wanted to donate to them would come out and put food in their bowl. So they would collect the food and then return, to where they were and eat the food. And then afterwards, usually enter into a garden or a forest or sit beneath a tree somewhere and do their practice. And then sometimes in the evening, maybe get together and have a conversation or so on. Something, very simple lives. The Buddha, this was the way the Buddha lived. He would often in the afternoon, receive various guests who came to see him. So when you read the Pali Sutras anyway, you'll have stories of a Brahmin who would come and visit the Buddha in the afternoon and ask him questions, or one of the kings would come and visit the Buddha and ask a question. And so the Buddha's responses to these questions became the sutras, the different scriptures that we study so that we know how to follow the path. Sometimes the Buddha would go and visit teachers from these other wandering sects, and inevitably, the way the story goes is kind of, the Buddha wakes up in the morning and it's too early to go for alms, and he'll think, oh, I'll go and visit so-and-so and his disciples. And meanwhile, so-and-so and his disciples, the Buddha's still far enough away, so they're kind of hanging out, making a lot of noise and screaming and laughing and joking and, having a brawl. And then as the Buddha comes, their leader says, oh, here comes the Buddha. You guys better look better, and look like your religious ascetics and, come on. And so then they would kind of calm down. the Buddha would come and say, well, what were you discussing before I came? nothing, but we have a question for you. And they would ask the Buddha a question, or sometimes the Buddha would ask them a question. Okay, but they were usually in the Pali scriptures displayed as just kind of, very often quite undisciplined people. Whether they really were or not, we don't know, but that's how, they're portrayed. But often the Buddha would go there and ask them questions, or they would ask him questions. Sometimes these leaders from the other sects, they would come, or they would send a disciple to come to kind of try and engage the Buddha in a philosophical debate and get the Buddha tripped up and prove that the Buddha didn't know anything or that his views were contradictory. But inevitably, whenever they tried to do that, it didn't work because, the Buddha's teachings are so backed by reason and logic that he could explain very clearly to them why their own ideas were incorrect. And so according to the culture at the time, if somebody's was a certain teacher's doctrine was refuted, then generally those disciples became the disciples of the person who refuted the doctrine. And so, the Sangha community grew in that way because, the Buddha would be in dialogue with some of these people and their views would be refuted, and then they would see the truth in the Buddha's doctrine and convert and become Buddhists. Okay, then often in the evening the Buddha would give teachings, sometimes to the Sangha, and then he would do some more walking meditation and sitting meditation. And then often in the night he would go into the jhanic states and teach the devas. Yeah. And so he cared not only for human beings but also for the devas. So that's why when it talks in here, teachers of gods and humans, in the praise, that's why, because he also taught the devas. It's quite interesting if you read Achan Mun's biography. He's this kind of the founder of the forest tradition in Thailand. That's what he used to do. In the evening, he would go into various jhanic meditation states and then teach the devas who would come for teachings. And actually, at the beginning of a teaching in the Tibetan tradition, you may notice, you know, His Holiness often does this, is put his fingers together in the gesture of giving Dharma, and he'll recite a certain verse rather quickly, and what he's doing at that time is inviting all of the devas to come and also listen to the teachings. Okay, so so you had all these wandering almsmen. One thing that was quite unique in the Buddhist community was, and I mentioned this yesterday, that they didn't follow the caste system. So whether you were a Brahmin or whether you were a lower caste, when you entered the Dharma, when you entered the Sangha, you all became equal. And so the Sangha was kind of the affirmative action at the time of the Buddha, whereby, you know, because there you, you know, what you became depended completely on your own practice and your own intelligence, your own effort. You know, it wasn't according to caste. And even at the time, I forget who else was getting ordained at the time, but Upali, who was a barber, who was considered from the lower caste. There were some of the other monks, other men who were getting ordained at the same time as him, who, they were from the Sakyan clan, and they were a little bit maybe puffed up because they were from a higher caste. So they deliberately let Upali, you know, when you go up and you take the ordination 3x3, let him go first so that they would be junior to him as a way of subduing their pride. And Upali later became, at the first council after the Buddha passed away, he was the one who recited all of the Vinaya. So he became quite well known and very much appreciated, even though he was from a lower caste. So you had people from all different walks of life, all different castes coming and joining the Sangha. So that must have been really quite a training for them, you know, if you think about it. People who grew up in a society where you had a very strong identity according to your socioeconomic class, and then you go into the Sangha and it's equal opportunity unemployment, and you know, and you have no special perks, and you have to give up all your arrogance thinking that you were somehow special. You saw this very often when the Buddha would talk to the Brahmins, you know, they would, especially when some Brahmins would come and try and refute the Buddha and, you know, say, well, you know, we're from the Brahmin caste and we're born from the mouth of Brahma, the creator. We're holier and better than everybody else. And the Buddha would, you know, really refute that. And say, well, actually, the actual spiritual practitioner is the one who has sila, samadhi, and prajna, you know, ethical discipline, concentration, and wisdom, not the one who, you know, because of their genes or their blood lineage. Okay, so there's some interesting things going on at the Sangha at the time.